Good evening. My name is Paul Jacoby, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Jim B.
Jim Borghese, alcoholic. Amen. Here's a COVID beard. When I got sober, our founder was kind of, if you showed up with a beard, he'd kind of give you a hard time. And I was clean shaving for 35 years almost. And I didn't come into the group that way. I came in 1984 off of Venice Beach and didn't stick around, shaved my beard. I understood the reason was that he had explained it that, you know, that we hide behind, you know, mustaches and beards, and that's why, you know, he liked to have us clean shaving. And I understood that because every time I was trying to hide out from either police or someone else, I would, you know, shave a different portion of my beard and change my identity a little bit. So I could understand that. And that was the first thing I did was shave my beard off in 1984. And unfortunately, I didn't stay. I got to see Chuck Chamberlain give Clancy his last cake that Chuck gave him. And I don't know if it was that meeting or another Wednesday night, but I did some drugs in the bathroom, made sure I only did half so I wouldn't nod out during the meeting. And but I am an alcoholic. My claim to fame, I was born in Columbus, Ohio on Columbus Day. My parents were married on Columbus Day. Italian American. Columbus Day is a big holiday for us. Now I have to share it with Indigenous Peoples Day, but I guess everything can change. You know, now we're not men and women who have lost their ability to drink. It's people that have lost, but everything changes for the best, I think. You know, I drank and used as much as I could. I got in a lot of trouble. I could have come and gotten sober a lot earlier if Robert Cook would have been sober when he probably arrested me down at Venice Beach, but that didn't happen. I ended up coming in here out of county jail. One of the members of this group who I drank and used with was here, and he was still, you know, in the enlightened stage, trying to get everybody sober, or I think he did all through his life, and he brought me here. That was Jerome Berkovich. Back then, he was Henry Robinson. I actually, after I went out the first time, I got pulled over in a legitimate car, and I knew the real Henry Robinson. I knew his birth date. I knew all of that. And Jerome being sober, I figured, well, that was a good name to use, you know, because I knew I had warrants. And, you know, I got arrested for 3 drinking in public tickets under Henry Robinson. Even sober, he didn't clear that up yet. So I ended up clearing up his name for him. I showed up, bailed out under his name. And I said, you know, I just cleared up your name. You got to pay me for these warrants. And I think he negotiated me down to 50%. But anyway, so I ended up coming here. I did not think I could stay here. You know, my life, you know, was beyond any kind of management. You know, I did everything out there. Got in a lot of trouble, and then I came here, and I couldn't, you know, deal and steal, so I had to, you know, get a job, and I got a little job. I got a sponsor, and my first sponsor is actually here in the audience. Good to see him here, Rob K. And, you know, it was, didn't think I'd do it, but somehow, you know, listening to the stories and everything and you know, doing a failed attempt or a very small attempt at working the steps in the program, I was able to stay sober. And the need to drink left me, you know. After it took about 2.5 years before the need to look into people's cars as I walked by them, that took a few more years to leave me. But I'm one of the OG members of the class of 85. You know, like I said, I came in 84 and I looked around at people like John Leakey and I just said, that's not for me. I'll make you go out and drink. And I got involved. I did everything I could possibly do. I got, somehow I fell into taking pictures and I got to take pictures of, you know, like the Sober Club Med. I was doing those twice a year. I was taking, you know, up to 19, 20 banquet pictures a year. I heard Clancy speak, you know, 20 times at banquets and then also the other 5 to 10 times during the year. And my life got better, you know, and I got married here. I had a few kids. I did it the way, you know, the traditional way, you know. My wife was 5 months pregnant when we got married. I think that's what happens a lot here. And that didn't work out. After dating all the crazy women in AA, come on, you know who you are. I boarded a plane to Thailand and I fell in love with the country there. And I met a gal over there and I brought her back here and, you know, had a wedding, you know, off the pages of National Geographic. You know, where me and 7 of my friends, we were the first white men ever to enter the village. And, you know, and I brought her back here and it was quite a culture shock. And thank God for the sponsor I had at the time because he was very active in Al-Anon, also in AA. And I knew where to take her. And we're still married today. Coming up on 16 years, we have a little 5-year-old. I get a lot of times, you know, oh, what a cute grandchild you have, you know. My children did not produce grandchildren for me, so I had to make my own. So at 66, I'm chasing after a little 5-year-old, and you know. And my wife is very active in Al-Anon, and we have a very stable home life. You know, I've started a business 26 years ago, and you know, doing what I learned on commitments in this group has, you know, just been unbelievable in my business, you know, because, you know, Clancy would always say, do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. You know, if not, call. And in the construction business, there's a lot of flakes out there. And all I have to do is remember those words coming from Clancy. And you know, my business is, you know, it's taken off, you know, beyond my wildest dreams. And you say, you know, my life is, you know, beyond my wildest dreams. Well, I've got some wild dreams, but I could never imagine what I have today. And 7 years ago, we built a big, huge house in Thailand in the right where we got married. And, You know, the problem is nobody speaks English there, so I'll never retire there, but I can manage about 5 days there. But there, AA is everywhere. There's good AA in Thailand. There's great AA right here. And if you're new, you know, grab hold of some people, make some friends here, go to lots of meetings, get a sponsor, and your life will be good too. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Mary W.
Hi, I'm Miriam. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank my sponsor, Mary, for inviting me to share, especially at this hybrid meeting. As you can hear, I'm Irish, and I come from a... No, I didn't mean that for applause, but I'm Irish. And I come from a small farm, which is very important to say. And there are four of us in the family. And I was pretty straightforward, I guess, until I got to be five. And then I was very, very shy, or very, I suppose you'd say, maybe self-obsessed. But I could never really share anything with my parents. My parents were really great, wonderful people. They were not American, so they did not say, I love you, and all stuff like that. They did, I love you. And that's the way we grew up. I wanted to be a teacher when I grew up, so I geared everything towards that. And I ended up teaching and in Dublin. And I didn't... people in those days took pledges not to drink, so did I. And I held on to it. So I really had a good time in Dublin, even without drinking. And people would say, you know, not too much. There was not too much pressure put under us to drink in Dublin. But when I went to London for the summer, they'd say, well, why don't you drink? You're getting it for free and so on. And anyway, I didn't drink until I went to Spain one summer, got tired of the Vichy Catalan and the Gaseosa. So I started drinking wine. And that was the same evening, actually, that I got the idea about being a nun. So it's kind of funny. But those two things, I never planned to be. I never planned to be an alcoholic, neither did I plan to be a nun. And those are the two really very important parts of my life today, and I wouldn't change either one of them, actually. So when I came back to Dublin, I was able to drink and have a good time. But that thought about entering kept bothering me, so to speak. So one snowy February morning, my aunt and uncle brought me down to the middle of nowhere where I entered the convent. And it was literally the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a snowstorm and all that. So there was no such thing as alcohol down there. There was just a lot of tea and a lot of sausages and chips, because we really weren't into a balanced diet, because you have to have a lot of money to have a balanced diet, as you know. Our superior general came along, and she asked me if I would like to come to San Francisco and get ready for... we're going to have a mission in Mexico. And I said yes. I was all set, and I came to San Francisco, and I absolutely loved everything about it. I loved being with our sisters. I loved the Japanese kids. I loved the sunshine, and I loved the alcohol, because when you have a place in San Francisco, everybody wants to come and spend time. And our sisters were very hospitable, so it was great. I mean, I just loved... I thought happy hour, wine with dinner, after dinner drinks and so on. And that's when I got my concept of heaven, which for me was I felt just wanted to be in this big waterbed. They just came out at that time. And I wanted angels flying in with them, with all kinds of nice drinks. And not a tap to do, nothing to do, just relaxing and drinking. So, but I couldn't do it the way you're supposed to do it. I was always drinking too much. I remember the first time we went to see one of our sisters and we went through the wineries. When I got there, I had to go straight to bed because I couldn't stand up. And that was really what happened to me. I didn't do anything dramatic because there's nothing more boring than drinking in the convent. Just did nothing dramatic. I was just go places and couldn't stand up and had to, you know, just get that over with. So I came down to L.A. and I didn't like L.A. I didn't like reality that was attached to L.A. I didn't like looking at our sisters who were, some were dying with cancer and so on. So I drank more and more. And it was beautiful because we had friends who gave us wine by the gallon. We didn't have to pay, just picked it up and brought it home. And it was more of the same there. Every day, morning I'd wake up and I'd say, I won't drink today, but by 2 o'clock there was usually a situation that demanded wine, you know, a situation that demanded some kind of a response like that. So that went on, and another sister and I, we were, we drank together, and we also made major decisions about not drinking. We'd get together and talk about helping each other and so on. And it never happened. I mean, just, it didn't happen. So it went on in a progression like that. Actually, when I was in San Francisco, because one of the sisters said she didn't want to see any, you know, people having too much to drink. So I proved that I wasn't a problem because I didn't drink for a year and 5 full minutes, which was a real proof that I wasn't. So faculty meetings, any place we went, I drank too much. And I was always remorseful because it wasn't really because I went on, but it was because that was not the way I was going to behave. So then there was a series of things that happened. I went to Al-Anon, and Al-Anon helped me release with love like that in 2 minutes. I mean, 2 weeks, not 2 minutes. So then when I took my eyes off Sheila, she got sober. And then I just was left with myself. I used to go visit this friend of ours who was an alcohol counselor, Father Pat. And I would say, he would say, Mary, go to AA. And I would say, no, that's Sheila's problem. And so I didn't until the 9th of May 9th, 81, we had our first communion, and it was like the whole world caved in on me. So I went to Sheila on our way over from first communion, and I said, Sheila, I think I have the same problem as you. And she just left, and she said, why don't you call Nancy? So I called Nancy M, and Nancy said, Mary, why don't you come to the meeting and raise your hand? It was Saturday. So I came to the Way of Life meeting, raised my hand, and was attacked by about 50 women with cards. And there was nowhere to hide because I was just too big to hide. And Nancy became my sponsor, and each morning I called her at 10 to 7. And I'd say, Nancy, I don't want to go to school, because I was a teacher. And she said, Mary, turn it over to God. Every day for 2 years this went on. And I think in the end, Nancy got tired, so she flew to Hawaii. And when Nancy went to Hawaii, I said, that's it for me. I'm tired of the Pacific group. I'm leaving. I'm leaving AA. And people started getting after me to get a sponsor. So I got Mary as a sponsor. And that was really one of the great steps I've taken in life. But when I got Mary as a sponsor, she took to the bed for a year with a bad back. And but Mary, whether she was having problems with her back or whether she was flying to China with the president or whether she was, no matter what she was doing. And Mary has been an example to me because she showed me that whether you're just in terrible pain, whether you're having awful situations, whether you're on top of the world with everything successful, you know, it just, it's just, you work regardless. And Nancy had made me play volleyball at the yard, which was a really horrendous experience. I couldn't play, and but I had one. I did one great thing. I made more money than anybody else for the coffee can. Not me. I didn't swear, but everybody else was swearing like crazy. So I thought, that's fine. I said, I am not going to be intimidated by all these valley girls, so I kept coming back. And I was there every single week playing, but I could serve, and that was it. So all kinds of things have happened since then, like I became principal, didn't want to do that, prayed about it. In our sisters always say, pray about it, and they know that if you pray about it, you'll do it. So I prayed about it and I did it, and I had an awful lot of help from everybody here, because I have discovered that you don't need to know anything when you go and ask people for help. Once you've asked them for help, you've gotten the answer. Because once you've asked somebody for help, it shows that you're depending on God, because that's how he works, through people. I had a really good experience taking care of my mom for 4.5 months before she died. I was able to make amends to my mom. All hours of the night, I would get up and come down and help her. She would blow her referee's whistles given by my sister-in-law. And I would come down and I would take care of her. And that was the most spiritual experience I've had, really. The ninth step was the most spiritual experience. I've loved Zoom. I've loved going to meetings in Tralee, where I used to go. They even send me a 40-year chip. Now, I've never gotten excited about chips before, but that one I did. They sent me from Tralee, and I went to Santa Maria to meetings. And I just want to thank everybody who's here, especially my sponsor, Mary, and my AA sisters, and all of you. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Peggy C.
I'm Peggy. I'm an alcoholic. I was expecting a break, so I'm totally the shot out of the cannon here. Well, we are nothing if we're not adaptable. Boy, I just want to take a minute and say good on us, man, what we have accomplished in this last year, and that that we're here, and that we're in person. And who thought this last year that this was going to, that we were ever going to get here? I know I certainly didn't know what was coming. And you put a bunch of alcoholics and mix in some adult children of alcoholics, and man, we know how to adapt and survive under some very trying circumstances. And I'm very proud of what AA has done in this last time period. That's I want to thank Mary for asking me to speak in her defense before she knew we were going to be in person. I wanted to call and say maybe you should get someone to be your first in-person speaker. After the third time she reminded me I was going to be the first in-person speaker, I kind of got pressured and said maybe you want somebody who has a little more import. And then my sponsor, Kathleen, thank you so much for coming tonight, informed me that she didn't think Mary Murphy needed any input from me about programming. And so I decided not to. It is truly an honor to speak at the Pacific Group. I feel Clancy's presence here. And I am but one of multitudes to whom he carried this message of recovery and hope and transformed so many lives. And I'm particularly indebted to the Pacific Group because my husband of almost 27 years got sober here. And this is probably the only time in years you've come to hear me speak. So the pressure's on, the husband and the sponsor. And, you know, in large part, it's due to what he found here and the recovery that he found here that's given us a 27-year-old marriage that's just totally, that is blessed. So I owe you. If you're new tonight, I want to tell you, welcome. That's the most important thing you can know. Welcome. You're welcome here, and we need you here. And I hope that that you find some measure of relief here. So I've got to get going because I'm old and I got a lot to say. I have to really look up. I have, 38 minutes, 40 minutes, right? 38 minutes, to be precise. Where's the clock? Okay, anyway, Brian A. over there has that covered, right, Brian? He'll get the hook if he needs to. So I have to tell my story in kind of a linear fashion because I tend to be a little scatterbrained and it kind of keeps me on track. I was born in a small farming community in East Tennessee. My mother was a 19-year-old high school dropout, and my father was the son of the local bootlegger, so he was in high demand in that little community. And there was alcoholism, you know, throughout the family, just seeded throughout the family. My father was a geographic taker. When I was 5 years old or 4 years old, we were living in Detroit, Michigan, and my mother left him because he was a daily drinker, and he was an alcoholic. My mother left him, and we did not speak of him again for 20 years. And 20 years later, she called me. I was living in New York to tell me that he had died. My mother then was a young mother, and she dropped my brother and I at her parents' home and on this farm in Tennessee, and she was largely absent from my life for the next few years. And before I get going too much on that, I want to tell you it all turned out okay. Thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. But be that as it may, you know, our book says we don't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it, but it's been my experience that before I can not regret the past or shut the door on it, I must reckon with it. And I must reckon with the things that were instituted in me, the belief systems and the old ideas. In that family, there was sexual abuse. There was neglect. There was just poverty. And I talk about that because it's not so important, the circumstances of that, but so that when I got here, I had developed so much armor to protect myself against that abandonment, against that neglect, and against that abuse, that my goal was no one could get to me. And I wanted the world to know you could not break me. So I needed a drink long before I got one. My mother returned when I was 8 or 9 years old, and she became the best mother she could be, and I had a mother for the rest of her time here. She moved us to Los Angeles. I was about 15 years old, and I went to Canoga Park High School in the Valley, and it was the early 60s. And as I said, adult children were very resourceful. And I became very attracted as a 15-year-old to what was going on over in the Sunset Strip. So one thing that adult children can do is we can walk in any room and assess who has the power and who is a threat. And so I quickly recruited this the most popular girl in school, this cheerleader, you know, class president. And plus, she lived next door to me and she had a car. So she was really high on my list. She had all the requirements. I quickly corrupted her. We started, you know, we were like little students during the day, and by night we would go over to the clubs on Sunset. And in those clubs, you know, it was the 60s. It was just wonderful. And, you know, in those clubs, there was a two-drink minimum. And I noticed right away, I'm always interested in what alcohol does for us. And I realized that right away that it did something for me that it didn't do for my little cheerleader friend. And what I can, and I know all of this in hindsight, everything I know about who I am and what happened to me, I've learned by working a program here. But what I realized that it did for me is I always felt like the uninvited guest. I always felt unwelcome in my own family. I felt that I was an inconvenience. And when I drank that alcohol, it not only was I invited to the party, but the party had been thrown just for me. And the other thing that I noticed about that experience was from the first drink until my last, God willing, my last drink in 1986, I never got enough. Ooh, this is too complicated to pour here. Excuse me. You're not fooling around with this water. So I have to go pretty fast here. So, you know, I got that alcohol. I loved the alcohol. As I said, I went to Canoga Park High School. It was the 60s. We would hang out in these canyons, Box Canyons, Topanga Canyon. You know, Box Canyon, we had this little house. It was called the Stone House. And it was just a few doors down from where, you know, Charlie Manson landed and got his start in life. And we were in the Stone House, and we would sit on these floors, and we would smoke this weed and listen to Buffy St. Marie and pass these big jugs of wine around. And like I said, I never got enough. Late 60s, I moved to San Francisco, Marin County, and I thought I was really cool. It was the late 60s, but I was still dressing like Audrey Hepburn a la 1962. They, you know, this whole myth about hippies and how non-judgmental, from this day, you know, from that day to this, I have never met a more rigid, uptight, judgmental group in my life than a bunch of hippies. And God bless them, just because they're on the right side doesn't mean they're pleasant. You know, they were like, she's plastic. That was a big phrase in the 60s. And it meant you looked really straight. And because of that, I think, I was recruited by this law student, third-year law student from Berkeley. And this, to me, he was aged Hell's Angel. And it turns out that they needed someone just like me to join their little group and do a little transportation distribution for them. And that took me from Mexico to San Francisco to New York. I go to New York. I fall in love with New York. And, you know, I met someone there. And that period of my life was, the alcohol was still working. By the way, I didn't let these hippies deter me from drinking. I would escape from them and go over to North Beach and drink all afternoon and then lose my car. And someone would have to take me back to Marin. You know, it was a scene. So I get recruited. I'm flying around under phony names. And, you know, the first time I saw that big wad of cash, I was in. So I moved to New York. And at first, it was really, really glamorous. We spent the winters in New York, and we spent the summers in Greece, and, you know, we did a few side trips to make that pay off, because Greece is close to Turkey, And we were involved with this jazz club. That what a wonderful education. You know, I was exposed to some to just some really fabulous experiences. And had it not been for the fact that I was a daily drinker and that alcohol did that for me, it made me feel like I was invited. I went to places that this scared, damaged little girl that still lived inside me could never have gone. And I would go to this jazz club, and it was where, you know, the musician, it was on the Lower East Side when it was not safe to go to the Lower East Side. And I would go, and I would sidle up next to these jazz giants like Charles Mingus, right? And I would drink what he drank. And he drank Boilermakers. He was a huge man. And I really, you know, I would drink, and then I would start talking, and he would look at me and just tell the bartender, like, move her away. So anyway, this went on for a few years. And in the late 70s, we went to Greece one summer, and we came back from Greece. And it was just after the junta, but it was still, there was still a police state. And so we didn't get drugs in Greece, so we drank, you know. And you can adapt, you can, if you're thirsty, this alcoholic can adapt to anything, even ouzo. So we come back, and everyone that we know is using heroin. So I'm a fitter-inner, you know, I will do anything to make you like me. I lasted in New York. The loft in Tribeca went, the trips to Greece went, the Mercedes went, the clothes went, everything went. And at the end, we ended up living in his parents' basement apartment in Queens. And I was 27, 28 years old, and my life was over. I moved back to Los Angeles in the 78 or so, and I had a very expensive German sewing machine, which was the last thing I didn't pawn. I don't know what I thought I was going to be sewing. I also had this heroin habit and 20 cents in my pocket. And I lasted here about six, 8 months. And I ended up on the last couch commitment. And then I checked myself into Tarzana Psychiatric Hospital, Rhonda D's alma mater. And although I think Rhonda was at Camarillo, to be precise, because you must be accurate about these things. And I checked myself in there, and I very quickly, I went through hell the first 20 days because I managed to set the methadone clinic on fire because, you know, rules aren't for me, and I needed a cigarette, and they threw my ass right out of there, right into the general population. And I had to kick cold turkey, and there I kept hearing nobody ever died from lack of sleep, and it's true. Although I wanted to kill them at the time, but I knew then, and I know now that I don't have another one of those in me. And in Tarzana, thank you God for hospitals and institutions and for people that do that work, because in Tarzana, I got to hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous because they brought a meeting in on Thursday nights. And some of you probably, Johnny probably spoke at that meeting, and Danny T and Bobby and Clancy. And the message that they gave us was, you don't have to live this way anymore if you don't choose to. And I like to talk about this because there's a lot of people. Brian, how much more time do I have? I can't do the math. How much?
20 minutes?
Okay. Oh, good. Whew. I don't have to rush through this. So what happened to me in that period of time is that identification that keeps us here. I did not get step one. I just didn't get step one. I knew I was powerless over drugs, but I only mouthed that I was powerless over alcohol. And I did not know what that meant. But you know, it was enough to keep me here, and these messages that I was hearing was enough to keep me here for a year, and I stayed for a year. I did what I don't ever want to forget, and that was that I did not have that transformation that is necessary for this alcoholic to recover, because the load of armor and shame and all of that stuff had only added up over my years of addiction and my years of being out there. And it is too much to bear without recovery. It is too much to bear without that, you know, when Chuck C. used to say, that inside shower that we get here by working these steps. I just very quickly, I'm a fitter-inner, you know, it's very important to me what you think of me, and I will do anything for your approval. And I found out that you talk a real spiritual game. You talk about God a lot, so I was oh so spiritual. I had no conscious connection with God. I had nothing but talk. I had no walk. I did a fourth step there. It was a grudge list. And I did a fifth step that, you know, was some very inappropriate things that went on around that. And I stayed, you know, I stayed in that hospital for 6 months, and then I was out, and I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I talked the talk, and I did not walk the walk. And after I took my one-year cake, and before I took that cake, I had started planning what I was going to do. You know, I'm not one who believes in alcoholic thinking per se. I mean, I don't believe that we have alcoholic thinking when it comes to buying a car, for example. But I do believe we have alcoholic thinking when it comes to alcohol and matters of alcohol. So, you know, the stark raving sobriety, I could not bear it. All my everything was I was exposed, and I couldn't bear being exposed. And so I started thinking, and this is what I was thinking. And if you're in this room tonight or on this Zoom and you have this alcoholic thinking, for God's sake, tell somebody. I thought, you know, I never really liked smoking marijuana. So that's probably a thing that I could do that wouldn't really. And, you know, I had it all scripted out. And I'm not so sure that alcohol was ever my problem. I mean, I know I can't shoot dope anymore. That's pretty obvious. But, you know, I've just got to have a little something. So I recruited, I went with some friends of mine. I had kept my old running buddies, some of them. And one of them had a house in Mexico, which we were frequenting. I said, that's it. I'll go to Mexico, I'll drink, see if I get the relief that I must have. And if I don't, I'll just come back to AA and pretend nothing happened, because it's Mexico. And, you know, you get kind of a mulligan when you drink out of the country. So I go, and we go to Husong's, where the tequila is really cheap. And I did what I was to do for the next 8 years. I drank, I put as much alcohol in my body could hold. I threw up probably on someone's, on my host's really expensive shoes. That won't get you invited back. I blacked out and I passed out, and I was to do that for the next 8 years. I was a daily drinker. I was a blackout drinker. But I was able to get a legal job in an up-and-coming new industry, and people, you know, and clients really liked me because I was in sales and marketing, and I would take them out starting at 4 p.m. and encourage them to drink and pick up the check. I mean, who doesn't like that? And so this all came, what happened, part of my story is this. It's two events. One is I'm hosting this group of these industry leaders at Gladstone's, and we're all working on this multi-million-dollar project with my products. And I've been drinking since 4 p.m. I come out of a blackout and I'm talking. That's never good, never. And they're like. So I just go right back into the blackout. I figure there's really no no advantage to staying in this little scene. So the next day, the CEO calls me in, and apparently I had been telling them that I really didn't give an F about this project we were working on, that I had been a very big drug smuggler in my day, and I was planning on going back to it, and I went into details about roots in Afghanistan, and I apparently it went on for quite some time. And the thing about that is that, what I realized after inventorying amends and so forth is that I didn't get fired from that job. I did not get fired from that job, because what I realized is people loved me. People loved me, and I was not safe with your love. It wasn't safe because I was too broken. So, we alcoholics, we hang in. I went on for a week or so, and I'm driving home from lunch one day. The office was on Main Street. I'm driving home from lunch, and what I now know is the first of several spiritual experiences happened for me. In that car, there came a presence, and this presence washed over me. And the message that that presence gave me was this. It says, this alcohol that you're drinking has you just as enslaved as the heroin ever did. And then it left. But that was a truth that I could not turn away from, because you see, my secret was the alcohol had stopped working for me, and I still kept going for it. And it long after it had stopped working for me, because I didn't know that anything else was possible for me. And at the same time, I thought, I'm going to have to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only thing that seems to work. And then my life will be over. I was convinced my life would be over. And here's the decision that I made. Even if my life is over, if I just don't have to drink every day when I get up, that will be good enough for me. Such little hopes and such little things we ask for. I just didn't want to have to drink. I came to September 13th, 1986. I went upstairs to that meeting in Brentwood. I don't remember anything that happened in that meeting except for one thing. I came late, or just as the meeting was started, as we will do, newcomers. And the room was filled up, and a man got up and gave me his chair. And I took the chair. And that act of kindness started to chip away at the armor that I had built up for 38 years. I kept coming back. I heard the message. I kept coming back, and I decided I was going to do it your way for a change. I got a sponsor. Her name's Sandy M. I don't know if she's here tonight, but she's in this group now, and I got a wonderful sponsor. I wanted to drink. I had the obsession to drink for two or three months, every day, all day. And, we say don't make deals with God, or don't try to make deals with God. I made a deal with God. And what my deal was, I will do what is told to me around here. I will do the footwork. But one thing I am powerless to do is to take away the obsession to drink. You've got to do that, God. I'll do the rest. I'll do everything I can. You've got to take away the obsession to drink. And about 2 months later, I realized it was gone. It was just gone. And it's really never returned. There have been a couple of times when it seemed like a good idea to drink, but I wasn't obsessed about it, and I had a way to go. So I got busy in AA. I wrote that fourth step, and thank you God for responsible sponsorship, because in the middle of that fourth step, all the sort of the trauma of my childhood and so forth came up, and I became very overwhelmed and destabilized. And she says, let's put a halt to this for a minute, and you get some outside help on this, and we'll come back to the fourth step later. And I bless you, Sandy, if you're here, for doing that, because that started my healing with my family. I did that fourth and fifth step, and went on to do the character defects. And, you know, I really had a lot to clean up at work, obviously. And one of them was that, you know, I was a liar. I was a terrible liar. I would say, I just lied for entertainment, actually. And I didn't have a college degree, and these were all highly educated people, and so that necessitated a lie. And so I'm telling my sponsor, I confessed to my sponsor that I was a big fat liar, and I said, I can't tell these people, you know, I'll lose my job. After the little incident at Gladstone's, I don't think so, but anyway. So she gave me this great advice. You know, my recovery, when we say here that this is the easier, softer way, this has really been true in my case, because everything I have learned has been with love and kindness and a sense of humor. Thank you, God, for a sense of humor. We had one of our great sisters, Joan Worth, used to tell everybody, get down on your knees and pray to God for a sense of humor, because you're going to need it. So she told me, when you find yourself telling a lie, the next time you do it, you are to raise your hand and say, I have a correction to make. And that worked for me. And guess what? You do one of those, you stop lying. Because I didn't want to do any more. You know, I had to make a lot of amends in that job. And one of them was, for character assassinating and so forth. And my sponsor says to me, and I would gossip and care. I was just a disruptor. And so I made an amends to this man that I had just devastated his career, and he didn't really respond all that well, all that positively. He was like, well, I'm glad you're sober, but honestly, it was rough going there. And so I'm complaining to her about this, and because I'd heard all this podium talk about how, you know, there was some big embraceable lightning moment, but that didn't happen in that case. It happened in some others, but she said to me, well, that's not the end of your amends. You know, you have to stop that behavior that talking about people and character assassinating them. And I said to her, in all honesty, this is who came to you. What will I do at work all day? So we went on, I go from about 5 to 6 years. I'm go through what I call my desert, where it seems as though nothing is happening. One day is following another. There is nothing at all happening. And by this time, I'm starting to say, where's mine? I've done all of this. Where is he? Where's mine? And someone in my lineage who, Jeannie Johnson was, I guess, my grand sponsor. I was terrified of her. What a dragon she was. And she says to me, oh, honey, you're much too sick to be in a relationship. God wouldn't do that to one of his kids. And that's rude. And so what I did was, I had these, one thing that I'm really working on is not to believe everything I think. Because as I think, so will my reality become, I've discovered. But at that time, I really thought, nothing is ever going to happen for me. I'm in this desert. I would go around saying my life is a minimalist painting, you know, very monochromatic and a few thin lines. And I said, I'll never fall in love again. I'll never see Paris again, and I will never paint another painting. Now, mind you, I'd only ever painted one painting. One very large eye with a tear. And I thought I was Rene Magritte. But I know about manifesting, and I know about doing the footwork. And one day I was on a business trip in Seattle, and I had I happened to pass a passport place. And, you know, they say in Zen, stay awake for the happy miracles. And they say, we say in our promises, you'll be intuitively guided. And all of a sudden, I got this intuitive thought that, you know, if you ever want to see Paris again, maybe you should get a passport. So I got a passport, and I kid you not, within 2 months, my company sent me on this business trip to Europe, and I finagled them into paying for me to have a weekend in Paris. So that's number one that's down. And when I was in Paris, you know, they don't call it the city of lights and the city for lovers for nothing, because when I was in Paris, I realized this thing about love. And that was that what I was missing was not, I thought it was all about, this is, again, don't believe everything I think. I thought it was all about finding someone to love me. And what I realized there was that my emptiness and my hollowness around love was because I had no one to love. And I needed someone to love. So what I did was I saw this thing about, write down 5 things that make life worth living. So I wrote down 5 things. I had a real hard time, I have to say. I was maybe 3 years, 4 years sober. So I wrote down these things that make life worth living, and I wrote down these things that I loved. One of them was a piece of music or some poetry or my goddaughter or a friend. And I would just practice loving them. I would listen to that music, and I would practice the feeling of what it was like to love something. And pretty soon, I like to believe, I became lovable. Well, I became acceptable enough so that, did that just go on? Okay. So a little while later, I had met this man, and we became friends. Met him at Brentwood, and he asked me one night, what do you do on Saturday nights? And I said, I went through a mini fifth step. What do you mean? I have no life. I go to AA meetings. And he was like, well, I thought maybe you'd like to go to a movie. And so I said, okay, went to the movie. And we had dinner afterwards. And about halfway through, I realized it was a date. And then I got really terrified. Then I fell in love. You know, so that's number two. After 2 long years of dating, he asked me to marry him. Before that, I'd gotten Kathleen as my sponsor because I thought I needed someone who was actually in a marriage. And you know, I complained so much about him not proposing to me. Mainly it was about the ring. I really wanted the ring. And Kathleen said to me, if you don't stop this, I'm just going to make you buy your own damn ring. And so anyway, he proposed. We were married 27 years ago on July 16th. It was a wonderful wedding. We have a wonderful marriage today. I went on to have a pretty good career in that industry. And in 2008, all came crashing to a halt, and I became a painter. So all the 3 things that I never thought I would do, I did. And in the minute or so I have left, what I want to tell you is that I played so small with the things that I believed about myself and with the things that I wanted. And if this year has taught us anything as a group, it's that we in Alcoholics Anonymous do not have to play small. We can have big dreams and we can go for things. You know, I went back to college in sobriety where Brian A. over there was in my study group for a couple of years. And, you know, I decided that if that really took away a lot of my shame issues. You know, one thing I want to say about shame, because I know a lot of us have it, and I've had to work on that for a while, and that is that shame diminishes when it's given language. And I found a place to share about that in an appropriate way and in an appropriate place so that when I said everything turned out okay, when I made my amends to my mother, it became a holy moment. I made my amends to my mother, and I did not get into any of my feelings about her, about the fact that I felt she was responsible for what had happened, and none of that. I just stayed to my side of the street because, you know, one of the reasons I like to pay attention in Alcoholics Anonymous is you never know what's going to save your life. And I heard a man named Jerry Ayers talk about the amends one night, and he said, amends are not about saying I'm sorry. They're about saying I'm aware, and they are about getting free. And when I made my amends to my mother, it freed not only me, but her. And she could make her amends to me, and she could unload that weight that she had been carrying for all these years. And it was a holy moment, and I got to have 30 years of being a daughter with her. And that is a blessing that only came as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, my 1 minute light is on. I'm going to tell you my Clancy story. I hope you've heard enough to know that what I have found here has been miraculous, nothing short of miraculous. So I worked for these companies that were based back east, and I had to go back there every quarter to get a review, and I was always convinced every single time I was going to get fired, and I would build this legend of why I should be fired. One morning I was in the red carpet club going to one of these, what I believed was a slaughter, and I see Clancy across the room, and he's getting a cup of coffee, and I run over, and I said, oh, you know, I reminded him who I am, and can I talk to you? Okay, he says, and he sits down with me, and I tell him my tale of woe and how I'm going to get fired. And he listens, and I notice that he's just drinking his coffee, and when it was almost finished, he said to me, well, I don't know if you're going to get fired or not, but it's not your fault anyway. It's their fault. They knew who you were when they hired you. And I'm thinking, they didn't, no, but I didn't correct him. And then he got up because his coffee was done, and he looked over his shoulder, and he said to me, and just remember, you don't have to let them know how crazy you are. And like I said, this is the easier, softer way, because that taught me more than any MBA I could have ever gone into. I bless you. I thank you. I'm so glad we're back. God bless.
We are changing how we do birthdays. So just so you know, we celebrate birthdays at this meeting for every 365 days of continuous sobriety. We give a cake with the number of candles. So what we're doing now, because the steering committee wants us only to sing happy birthday once, is everybody who's taking a cake is going to come up on the stage, and we're all going to sing happy birthday once. So for us, we define birthdays and sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or heroin, as we might say, or anything which affects you from the neck up. If you're a regular attender of the meeting and would like to take a cake with us, see me at the door before the meeting. And so now come up onto the stage if you are taking a cake, and the birthday people and the sponsors, is everybody here? Okay, are here, and now... Okay, I'm not going to lead the singing because I'm really bad. But so let's all sing happy birthday briskly, okay? And we're going to speak briefly. First birthday is for 1 year for Savannah F., and her sponsor is out of town, so her grand sponsor, me, is going to give her cake.
Hi, I'm Savannah. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very, very grateful to have 1 year. I'm thankful for my sponsor, Emma, who is in D.C., but she's the best. Mary, who is my grand sponsor, and the Pacific Group for giving me a cake. Thank you so much for everybody.
Our second cake is for 3 years for Danny R., and her sponsor, Barbara B., will give her a cake.
Hi, I'm Danny. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Barbara B., my grand sponsor, Mary Murphy, and all of you. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for 7 years for Toby M., and Brian A. will give him his cake.
I'm Toby. I'm an alcoholic. I would like to thank God, my sponsor in the Pacific Group. Look at you guys.
Our next birthday is for 10 years for Matt H., and Roy A. is giving him his cake.
Thank you. My name is Matt. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date is June 30th, 2011. Roy A. is my sponsor, and this is my new home since the start of COVID. I love AA. You know, everything in my life that I have today is a direct result of this program. This is so incredible to be here with you guys tonight, celebrating 10. I've got chills. I'm so grateful. I love you guys. Thank you.
Okay, we missed one birthday, and that's for 9 years for Bonnie T. And Terry is giving her a cake.
Hi, everyone. I'm Bonnie. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, my amazing sponsor, Terry B., my AA sister, some who are here tonight, the women I've sponsored, one is here tonight as well, AA and PG. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for 13 years for Ilya, and her sponsor, Yvonne, is giving her a cake.
Hi, my name is Ilya. I'm an alcoholic, and I would like to thank Pacific Group. Pacific Group has changed the course of my life and has changed the course of my family's life, and I'm so grateful. I'd like to thank Clancy for the structure, Clancy and Charlotte for the yard, the Aristocrats, my AA sisters, and my sponsor, a woman who has consistently shown me how to change my mind and how to be of maximum service. Thank you so much.
Our next birthday is for 14 years for Raymond, and Brian A. will give him his cake.
Hi, I'm Raymond Lee, an alcoholic. And thank you, AA, thank you, Pacific Group, and my great sponsor, Brian A., and all of you.
Our next birthday is for 22 years for Frank N., and Robert C. will give him his cake.
My name is Frank Nielsen. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank God, AA Pacific Group, Clancy for 20 years of sponsorship, my new sponsor, Robert Cook, Class of 1999, and all of you, and Zoom.
Our next birthday is for Roger A. for 31 years, and Jerry C. is giving him his cake.
Hi, Roger Alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, Alcoholics Anonymous, Clancy and the Old Timers, Jerry for 31 cakes, Pacific Group, and the class of Yo 9-0.
Our next birthday is one of our 10-minute speakers, Jim B., for 36 years, and Glenn R. will give him his cake.
Jim Borghese, alcoholic, and I want to thank Glenn for that cake. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I'm so grateful for the old timers for having the doors open for when I came in. And I didn't mention in my 10 minutes that the doors were open for my middle son to come in, and he's here tonight. I think he's got like 3 years. So having three boys is a blessing, and having one in Alcoholics Anonymous is more than a blessing. I want to thank you.
Thank you. Our next birthday is for me. For 44 years, Mary M. and Meg S. is giving me. I'm Mary, an alcoholic. I want to thank my daughter Meg for giving me that cake. I want to thank my sponsor Kevin. She lives in San Francisco, and she ignited the flame of Alcoholics Anonymous for me, and she brought me into AA, and she's been my sponsor for 25 years, and I love her so much. I want to thank the Pacific Group. The Pacific Group literally saved my life. I thank you so much, and I want to thank Clancy for all the love that this man gave me. I mean, I am one grateful woman, so thank you very, very much. Okay, so now we have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our cake. And at the end of the year, the candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. So see my assistants at the door when you sign up to take your cake. If you are, I got to put my glasses on. I can really see. All right, if you're participating online, oh, I forgot the online birthdays. Huh? Did I forget the Zoom birthdays? Okay, sorry. All right, hold on, everybody. We have birthdays on Zoom. So the birthdays on Zoom are, for 6 years, Kenny T, and his sponsor is Charlie H. For 10 years, Evie B, and her sponsor is Joan Van T. For a former secretary of the Pacific Group, Charles K., and his sponsor is Tim K. And for 50 years, for Lynn S., and her sponsor is Nancy M. So that totals 383 years of sobriety. How amazing. 18.9 average. Okay, now back to, all right, here we go.